This is Anthony Iannarino, and you're listening to In the Arena.
Alan Alda is an internationally recognized actor, writer, and director. He's won a staggering 7 Emmy Awards, received 3 Tony nominations, is an inductee of the Television Hall of Fame, was nominated for the Academy Award for his role in The Aviator, but most of us who know Alan Alda's work know him for Hawkeye Pierce on the classic television show MASH, which was beamed into my living room as a child every single night, and it made me think it was about Vietnam as a kid, even though it was really about Korea. I invited Alan into the arena to talk about his new book, which is titled, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. And I think this is a very, very important book about how we communicate and how we relate. And if you would like to be known, liked, and trusted, and have the ability to have people understand the value that you create, this is a great book and it's a great podcast. Alan Alda, In the Arena. First, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And I want to apologize for having to ask you one question outside of the new book first, but I just have to know.
Let me see if I can guess what that's going to be.
Yeah, go ahead. See if you can guess.
Does it have the letters M-A-S-H in it?
I have to. There's just no way to avoid it. As a kid, I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's house while my mom was at work, and your voice came out of the TV every single day. And it's so interesting. There were only 3 channels then, and you were one of them. And I just have to ask you, what was that like for you being a young man and an actor? And you're literally part of the cultural zeitgeist of America. It had to be an incredible experience to go through.
Well, it may surprise you, but we didn't realize that we fit the description you just gave. We were locked away in a dark studio, a little too small for what we had to do because they didn't think we'd be a success. And we were working 12 or 14 hours a day, and we weren't mixing with the people who were being affected by it. Except once in a while, we'd be walking through an airport and somebody would come up to us as if they were part of a secret gang and say, keep up the good work.
It's interesting. At that time, my grandmother had lost a son in Vietnam, and I was just a kid. So when I was watching this, I thought I was watching Vietnam.
Yeah, well, a lot of people, it was about Vietnam, or at least a stand-in for it.
Yeah.
And I think some of the writers dealt with it that way. When I wrote for it, I just believed I was writing about Korea, but Korea, for me, stood in for every war, not just Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting observation. It was a stand-in for all of them. It is just such a cultural thing that I just had to know what that was like for you. And it's interesting, your head's down working, and we have this perception of what that must be like for you, and it's nothing like that. You're just heads down working.
And it ought to be, because if you're thinking about what a big deal you are, you get slick and slimy and not interesting. It has to be spontaneous and naive and intuitional. You can't walk through the door every week saying, watch us, this is going to be great.
That's interesting. I'm more than halfway through your new book, which the publisher sent me a copy of. And I've done a couple things. I'm reading it and I'm listening to it. And I want to talk about both of those and the difference in just a minute. But I want to start out with your central premise in the book, If I Understood You, Would My Face Look Like This? And your central premise at the beginning is everyone misunderstands everyone else. Maybe not all the time, but enough to mess things up. And I smiled when I read it, and then I'm sort of horrified by it at the same time because I recognize how much I'm afraid that this is true, that we're having what we believe is a conversation, and we believe there's communication happening, But then we have some events occur where we realize that communication, the way that I thought it went, didn't happen at all. How did you discover this fact? And even more than that, tell me how you live your life now knowing that this is true. And I'll just tell you, as I'm preparing for this, I'm reading that thinking, I'm responsible for my side of the communication with Alan Alda today, so I better raise my game, just having read as much as I have.
Well, that's a nice compliment. Thank you. Well, the answer is that I found out how difficult it was to understand and be understood just through ordinary experience all my life. And I noticed that people weren't hearing what I said, and I noticed I wasn't really understanding what other people were telling me. And it is crystallized when you talk to somebody who's trying to explain something extremely complicated to you, the way I spent 11 years trying to get scientists to explain their work to me, in spite of the fact that they used concepts and words and described processes that I didn't understand. And I had to try to break that down and get them to talk plainly to me and not betray the truth of what they were saying, not betray the accuracy. I wanted them to be accurate. I didn't want them to dumb it down and leave me as stupid as I was before, but thinking I knew something. I wanted them to really teach me something. And in that process, I became aware of the importance of making a connection with the other person that's a personal connection. If all you do is say words at them that you think are perfectly formulated to express what you have in mind, but you don't know how it's landing on the other person, then you're in the position of the title of the book. If I understood you, would I have this look on my face? If we're not paying attention to the other person's signs that they're not getting it or that they misunderstand it completely, and sometimes those signs are on the face and the body language and the way they speak, tone of voice, if we don't take that into account, the chances of failing at the communication are pretty high. And if we do take it into account, it's not going to be perfect, but it'll be much better off.
You tell a story at the beginning of the book about an experience that caused you, I think, to have this manifest in some way that you decided to do something about it. And it was a dental surgery that you had where you actually had, I don't remember the word, frenum?
Frenum. I got the word frenum from my research, and doctors tell me it's frenulum. So I
all right, we're close.
But it's that little, whatever it's actually called, it's that little bit of tissue between the upper part of your gum in front of your front teeth, between that and your upper lip. And I never knew what it was for. I don't know entirely what it's for, but one thing I now know it's for is to help your upper lip go up when you smile. And the surgeon, the dental surgeon, before he did this operation on me, which was some special operation he had invented as part of taking out a tooth, he said, and now there's going to be some tethering. And I had no idea what he meant by the word tethering. I mean, he has the scalpel inches from my mouth, and he's telling me there's going to be tethering after the operation. And I still don't know what he meant. He never explained it. I said, tethering? And he started yelling, tethering, tethering. And I never got past that because I was impressed with his surgical gown and went along with what he wanted to do. And then I found out a few weeks later, shooting a movie, that I couldn't really smile the way I had smiled before. The cameraman said, well, I thought you were going to smile in that shot. I said, I did. He said, no, you were sneering. So I called the dentist and tried to explain that I need my face for smiling in my line of work. And I wasn't even as snarky as that. I was very polite. And he said, I told you there were two stages to this operation. And he apparently was going to go back and fix my frenum. I don't know. But I can't remember if I went back or not because I didn't trust this guy.
Not after that. And the communication broke down. And were you trying to express something other than tethering? I mean, were you trying to express, look, I have a concern about the surgery I'm about to have?
Well, but the thing is, I wasn't communicating very well because if I don't understand, I need to find out what the person's talking about, no matter how obstreperous they get. But he was really not communicating, and it was his responsibility to help me follow him.
Yeah.
I'm there at the other end of the knife, and his job is to make me comfortable, to help me let me give consent to what he's about to do. So if he says, I'm going to do a furbuffism on you, I want to know what furbuffism means before you do it.
That would be helpful. And it would also be helpful to know that you're not going to be able to smile as an actor, because...
Well, that would be nice, yeah.
That's the whole thing. I took an acting class to help me become a better public speaker. And my teacher said to me at one time during a cold read, he said, you know, we're supposed to know what you're feeling by looking at your face. And I have no idea. And I was really good at the listening and trying to take in what the other person was saying. But the giving it back is really, really difficult. And I think for us in human relations, what I think of with your dentist is that it was a transaction to him. Alan comes in, he sits in the chair, I do the surgery, Alan leaves. And Alan could be anybody, right? I could replace that with anybody.
Don't leave the part out where he leaves and I bill him.
Yeah.
That's the essential part of the transaction. When I told him that I was upset, he sent me a long letter explaining why he shouldn't be sued. And his mind was on that most of the time, not on me.
Well, he thinks he damaged your instrument, which in fact, for whatever it was you were shooting, he did in fact damage your instrument.
Yeah, but I never had any mind to sue him. I just I called him to let him know he should be a little more forthcoming to other patients.
Yeah.
But he took it as a threat, which I don't think helped at all.
I had a brain surgery when I was 25, so that's going on 25 years from the date that we're recording this. And I had I tell people the difference between my neurosurgeon and God is that God doesn't think he's my neurosurgeon. Same demeanor. But you don't want a nervous brain surgeon either. You want somebody who's confident. And I think that's part of the trap that they fall into with the communication is they're very confident. And you like that, but also it hurts the relationship. Let me get into some of the content in the book. And I want to give people a feel for what's in here, because I am floored by the content of the book. And it's something that I find to be, one, meaningful, but two, actionable. And I want to start with this idea that you take from acting on just relating. And if you could explain what relating is from the actor's point of view, and then I want to understand, why is it that we avoid that as human beings? Is it something about our vulnerability, or what is it that causes us to not relate when that's really one of the foundational ideas in the book for communicating more effectively?
Let me take that last part.
Okay.
I really wonder myself why we retreat from relating, because it's such a fundamental human function. We're social animals. At least that's what we keep telling ourselves. And yet, every time we build up the ability to make a personal connection with other people, we start to retreat from it. Maybe it's because you can't do it without being a little vulnerable. Maybe a lot vulnerable. You have to have the confidence that you have the strength to be vulnerable and maintain your own independence at the same time. Maintain your own sense of what's right. Being vulnerable doesn't mean you hand yourself over body and soul to another person. It just means you open yourself up and they open themselves up and you have an exchange that's more effective, because you're really, really talking to each other now. You're not talking to the idea of each other, what you wish the other person were, or what you suppose the other person probably is based on some stereotype you have of them. So the first part of the question, what is relating? Now that I've said we tend to shrink from it. Relating to me is, just let me start with what I learned about it as an actor. I didn't really know what it was when I started. I knew it was important. I knew it had something to do with the other person. And I thought it was getting into their face. People would say, you're not relating, relate more. I'd lean over and get my face right up against their face. And it doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with responding to them, being open to them, letting them into your field of vision, into your consciousness. It's very easy to go out on stage and say all the lines you've memorized and say them in a way you've decided is the appropriate way to say them. That's the way most amateurs start out. It's the way many professionals start out, and the way some professionals continue to act. to figure out a performance and then do it at the other person, regardless of what they're doing. I used to know a director who said about an actor, he would keep acting the same way if the scenery fell down behind him. If the scenery falls down, you got to make a reaction to what you, I mean, what's going on here? Is this an earthquake? What's happening? But the main thing about relating to another person, another actor, for instance, is that you should be able to say the same lines every night, standing in the same place, and have it come out of you in a different way, depending on how the other person makes you say it. You are responding to them, not just with the way you say it, but with your whole body, including your face, which you mentioned before. If you took that teacher's advice and decided, I'm now going to make a face that corresponds to how I want the other person to understand that I'm getting it, it's going to look mechanical and possibly even a little weird and scary. But if you let the other person in and respond on a almost an unconscious level, where the parts of your body that are not consciously contacted by your brain, but only at an unconscious level, then your response will be genuine. Your face will reveal how you really are taking it in. And you have to be, you have to not only be brave enough to let it happen, you have to be experienced enough to let it happen. You have to practice this. You don't just, you know, the only thing wrong with my book, which I'm very grateful that you have said such nice words about it, and I'm proud of it too. But the only thing wrong with it is it's written down on paper. And I don't think, I'm worried that some people will think all they have to do is read the book and they're going to be changed. I think change comes through transformational experiences. I think there are things you can do, whether or not you go to a class and take part in training in this. There are things you have to do by yourself on your own where you practice it. It's like going to the gym. So let me get back more to what I think relating is. I think it's making contact with the other person in the same way that as an actor, I say, I find my performance in the other actor's eyes by relating to the other person, by establishing this relationship with them where they're really important to me. I don't know how I'm going to react until I see what they give me. That's the beginning of an open personal relationship.
And this is something that we can take outside of just acting, but I'll go back to just one more of my acting experiences because I think you'll enjoy it. I had a scene that I was supposed to do with a young woman, and we were a married couple, and she was angry at me. And she'd been acting for years, and this is maybe my second acting class ever. And she gets right up in my face and just lights me up with all of this energy that I could feel in my body, the anger starting because she was so close to me and so physical and so mad. But then when I went to say the lines that I was supposed to say, it basically came out something like this. I mean, nothing came out. And I'm standing there and I'm full. I've taken in everything that she's given me, but I can't give any of it back. Because we're not used to doing that kind of a thing. We're used to holding back those emotions and keeping them inside. And then when you're supposed to let it out, the instrument didn't work for me.
That's so interesting. Well, practice.
Yeah.
You have to experience things over and over again. It's a good example of what I like to say. I don't like to get, you know, we teach communication. All the Center for Communicating Science, and we've taught 8,000 scientists and doctors around the country and across the world. And we try not to give them tips as much as people really want tips. What are the three things I need to remember, and then I'll communicate better? Well, I don't think it works that way. I think you have to have things you can do that change you. Like, you know, what are the three tips I can give you so that you'll have a rippled belly?
Six-pack, yep.
Six-pack belly, yeah. I don't think there are tips that's going to give it to you. I think you've got to do those sit-ups or whatever you have to do. I personally don't have one, but I don't know. You have to go through something. You can't just hear about it.
I tell people this about what I teach, which is mostly about sales and leadership, is that you don't learn how to swim from a book. I mean, you're just not going to do well in the water.
Yeah. And we all want the shortcut, but as long as you have something reliable to try out and do over and over, you'll get somewhere. And then that gets back to this strange thing that relating is pleasurable. and you get somewhere with it. You get the communication you've been looking for. And yet, if you don't keep working on it, it goes away. The empathy that you build up, the ability to see what's going on in the other person's emotions, you lose that unless you keep after it. And I don't understand why, but you brought up an interesting question before. And for the first time, I think I'm beginning to see maybe it has to do with the fact that you feel vulnerable when you're doing that, because your emotions are affected as well.
And I have to open up to that. I think it's something about the fear that we have as humans of being judged, of being inadequate, of not belonging, and all of these deep human needs. I want to get to that because I think a lot of what's in your book is really deep evolutionary stuff that I think this is just coming through us because of the way that we've evolved over time. It feels like a lot of that. Let me ask a couple more questions, and then I want to get to that empathy, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
But I want to ask you about what is responsive listening, and if you could list out the mistakes that we make that prevent us doing what's really responsive listening rather than some of the things that other people might have heard we're supposed to be doing.
Right. Well, I think that's a term, responsive listening. I think it's a term that's been used a lot. I can only give you my version of it. I think you have to let the other person know you're listening. It's not a good idea to look at your iPhone while the person's talking to you, which people actually do.
You've just described about 172 out of the 315 million of us, I think, at any given moment.
Another thing is, it's good to let the other person know that what you think you heard them say and get them to agree that that's what they said, so that you both know, you both have a better understanding of what was said. But none of these things can be done mechanically. You can tell when somebody has read something about responsive listening when they say, "Now it seems to me that you've said this, and here's my response to that." You know, it's so formulaic that I don't feel I'm being listened to. I feel that I'm in some kind of a machine that this person is grinding me through. Here are the words you said. Here are what I heard you say. Now I'm going to deal with those words. The words, you know, in acting, for instance, there's a lot I learned about this from acting. In acting, the acting or the performance or the story is not being told through the words alone. The acting takes place between the words. It's what your whole body is going through, what your tone of voice is, how your tone of voice is affected, what's on your face. That's the essential part of the communication. The words themselves, I think, are an adjunct to the whole thing you're going through, to the whole feeling and intellectual process you're going through. They're the smallest part of the communication. So if all you're dealing with is the words and you're not taking in the whole person, you're missing a lot of what's happening. And you can actually get to miscommunication if you do a mechanical version of a responsive listening, I think. So it really goes back to this complicated idea of relationship.
And it's interesting because for me, that's the whole thing, is the relationship. That's what matters most of all in any communication. And I think that the trend right now is towards more transactional. And I think a lot of this is driven by technology. Now that we can order something from Amazon, there's no human being that we're engaged with. The book shows up at my house. And, you know, before this, I'm a bibliophile, so I have an illness that requires me to buy dozens and dozens of books almost daily. And I had a bookseller, and the bookseller knew my interest.
You may not be a bibliophile. You may be a hoarder.
I might. When it comes to books, I may be a hoarder. Fortunately, on the Kindle, I have a lot of books, but you can't see them, so I don't have to feel the guilt of being a hoarder, at least. But I had a person who was a bookseller, and he knew my interests, and he would call me, and he would find, you know, rare books, first edition things that he knew I wanted, and we had a relationship, and I made sure that I bought from his bookstore, and he made sure that I was being taken care of and what I wanted. And I think a lot of this is the nature of relationships is being pushed towards being more transactional, and I think that's disruptive to communication because we are relational creatures more than we are transactional creatures, and I think that that's still going to be true for a long time. I'm going to ask you about AI later on, but I hope it stays true.
Well, it's so interesting you mentioned the book selling. I think booksellers call that hand selling, where they actually evaluate what would be good for you to read, so they give you a good reading experience. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking with Ann Patchett, who is a great novelist who owns a great bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee. And I told her that one of the things in my book is a reference to something that Daniel Goleman had said, that when you're selling somebody something, you have to not only not sell them simply what you want them to buy, and not only what they want to buy, you have to sell them what you truly, honestly believe they need, and have to be kind of firm about what they need as you evaluate it, because you're really helping them get someplace important. And Ann Patchett said, it's absolutely true. When I'm in the bookstore and somebody's online and I find out that they haven't read a book in a few years, and she says, we get a lot of customers like that, just starting out reading again, and they're holding a book by a difficult author, I take it out of their hands and I say, don't read that. Read this. This is going to be a better experience for you. And they're grateful for it. And she's got a customer for life because they feel cared for, and you've actually done them a service. You haven't just sold them. Now, let's say that complicated book cost more per copy. You've still made more money out of that transaction because they come back.
There's no doubt about it. We're serving their longer term needs. And I agree with Goleman's position right out of the gate. I think that it's difficult to help people change in the way that they want to change. And for me, as somebody who works in sales and leadership, you know, the communication is the currency for that. And so if it doesn't have the caring and it doesn't have the empathy, and I'm not looking out for people's longer term needs and it's transactional, then the communication, in my opinion, is going to feel that way. And it's not going to inspire or help people to really change. I want to move us just a little bit forward because I have you for a short time. And I want to talk about a few things. You got to the part in the book where you're talking about empathy and theory of mind and Jefferson's Head and Heart, which I'll point people to. Just as you're reading this book, you should read that section by itself and just ponder on that for a while. But I want to ask you, how do you read someone's emotions? And I wonder if you have a section about mirror neurons, which is has been covered a lot in magazines, I think, like Scientific American, which I know you've done a lot of work with. But how do you listen with your eyes so that you can read minds? And if you could just share anything about what's our responsibility when we're sitting and we're trying to communicate with another person when it comes to having both the empathy and the rational conversation that we want to have with that individual or need to have with that individual?
I mean, it sounds crazy, for instance, to say you have to read the other person's mind. And really what I mean by that is that it almost is as if you're reading their mind. You're getting a good estimation of what's going on inside them, regardless of what their words are telling you. Because very often we say things that don't reflect how we're really feeling or even what we're really thinking. And if you're just going to go on that data, it's not going to be useful to you. You have to take the whole message in. So if we're talking and I see you're frowning while I'm talking, or I see you looking away at key moments where that means to me you don't want to say it, but you don't agree with what I'm saying, or I see that you're getting pink in your cheeks and you might even be getting angry, but you're not saying it, I've got to cope with that. It's amazing. When I was younger, I didn't cope with those things, and I blundered my way through a lot of conversations, a lot of meetings and sales talks, where I was ignoring the message I was getting because it just felt sufficient to deal with what I was hearing. And you can get an enormous amount of information that gives you a chance to have a pretty good picture of what's going on inside their head, both in their feelings, which you get through empathy, and in their thoughts, which you get through what scientists call theory of mind, which is a state of consciousness in a way that we get when we're about 4 or 5 years old, when we begin to realize that somebody else can have a different understanding than we do. They can be thinking something other than what we're thinking. They know things that we don't know. Until 4 or 5, we don't know that. And we don't know what makes any sense to lie because they think what we think. So people start lying when they realize that you can be thinking something different. So there really is this barrier between us, that we can find our way through that barrier by picking up the clues coming from the other person. We give off clues all the time, but it's getting used to getting those clues, understanding them, figuring them out. It's in doing that that we can build up empathy and know what's going on in the other person.
I just want to disagree with one point, and the way that you described that is that after the age of 4 or 5, people then understand what other people are thinking and that they don't share their same beliefs. But in my experience of almost 50 years on the planet, they don't get that at the age of 5 or 18 or 38 or sometimes at all. That doesn't develop in everyone at the same speed. And it's a capacity that we have as we develop. And if you look at the developmental psychologists, they say we're still growing all the way into old age. We continue to grow and develop. But that ability to take another person's perspective, I think that that's where empathy comes from. It's the perspective taking to say, what must that be like for them? And can I put myself in that perspective?
And by the way, there are people, scientists or writers in any case, psychologists, who don't think we're very good at all at taking the other person's perspective. And I disagree with that point of view, because I don't think actors could play different characters if they couldn't, to some extent, take on the perspective of another person. Novelists couldn't write a whole phalanx of characters with different characteristics. Playwrights couldn't do it. To some extent, we seem to be able to take on the other person's perspective, but not entirely.
Right.
People will still make assumptions about what people are thinking and feeling, and will be totally wrong, no matter how much we practice it. But we can make it much, much better.
Can I give you two more questions?
Sure.
Quickly. I want to ask you about your health, particularly your great brain and your voice. And what do you do to remain so sharp? And for your voice is still the same voice that beamed out of my television. And it's some level of health, I think, that's indicated in the youthfulness in your voice, especially in the delivery of that book.
Oh, well, that's very nice. I appreciate that. What did you say? My voice and my what?
Your sharp mind.
Oh, my mind. Oh. Well, thanks. Thanks on both counts. You know, actually, I do work them both out deliberately. As I get older, I don't have a strong voice. My voice has got weaker, and I do vocalizing exercises. If I don't do them twice a day, I don't have the voice you're hearing now. And the same thing with my brain. I work my brain out deliberately to try to keep sharp. It's this annoying thing, like the muscles get soft if you don't work them out, and I don't work them out nearly as much as I should. But I've been told by brain scientists, use it or lose it. And it's just like muscles. So I guess we're stuck with that. The longer we're here, the harder we have to work to really be here in as strong a way as we'd like to be.
It's exactly backwards from how we would want it. We would want to actually get stronger going the other way, but I don't think we're going to get a vote on that. One other question. You're engaged in an organization around the safety and the controls around artificial intelligence. Can you just comment on what that organization is and what your work is there?
It's the Institute for Life. It's got a title. And a lot of very smart people, who dwarf me in intelligence, are on the board of this organization. And it really represents a response to some of the things like artificial intelligence that, while their remarkable advances in scientific achievement have in them the possibility of being really dangerous, strongly dangerous. Artificial intelligence, for instance, has already reached the point in some areas where it does your thinking for you. Self-driving cars are an example. And somebody has raised the question, how are we going to put into a self-driving car the ethical decision-making that seems to be necessary if the car is going to be making decisions? Does the owner of the car have the right to have the priority of safety if you're about to plow into six school children? Or should the car take you into the telephone pole instead and save the six school children? Or simply because you had enough money to buy the car, do you have the right to plow down the kids? And that's an extreme example of an ethical consideration. But even before you get to ethical considerations, there's the problem with artificial intelligence that the more it gets to be able to control more of our lives without consulting us and without letting us know how it's arriving at those decisions, the more dangerous it is. Where's the kill switch? Where's the ability to say you're valuing things wrong or you haven't kept up with changes that are clearly taking place? But you're learning on your own. The thing about artificial intelligence is it learns on its own the same way a person learns on their own. They accumulate experiences, they learn from them, they do better. It has even greater capacity than a child does learning because a child is given an environment. And artificial intelligence, I think, can reach out beyond any given environment to all the world's knowledge. And as computing gets more powerful, it'll reach out to more knowledge and it'll arrive at conclusions because it's not working from a set algorithm that we've written. It's learning these things on its own. We won't know how it's arrived at those conclusions. It might not even be able to tell us how it's arrived at those conclusions. So it's something that really takes a lot of thought because nobody is suggesting that we stop work on artificial intelligence, but it may be that not enough people are saying we need to be aware of the dangers and we need to do something to keep up with the tools we're creating, or we'll die from our own tools.
I don't want to take us down a rabbit hole because you're out of time, but I will say it's striking to me that we're not developing artificial moral intelligence in a parallel line. And if you think about how children develop, you are a nasty, foul creature in your teens, and you become a little better in your 20s and better in your 30s and better in your 40s and 50s and so on, more compassionate generally. You just wonder what line that takes and how long it would take for something like that to develop any kind of a moral intuition, if it's possible at all.
If it's possible. The thing is, so far, we don't have a machine that can do empathy better than a human can. And we don't have a machine, I don't think, that can balance the tricky elements of a moral decision better than a human can. And humans tend to be very often lousy at it.
We're not the best.
Yeah, right. And a lot of it depends on what your values are. Terrorists are not good to have around. They're not good when they're doing what they do. However, they're fighting for what they believe in. And don't we so often hear advice given to kids, fight for what you believe in? It kind of depends what you believe in and how it affects other people.
That's a good starting point.
Yeah.
Well, I've kept you a little over our time. Your book is If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? And it's brilliant. I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you, Anthony. I really enjoyed our talk. It's very nice.
That was the great Alan Alda. And you can find him on Twitter at Alan Alda. You can also buy his new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? You can buy that at Amazon.com. I was at Barnes & Noble this weekend, and it is on the shelves and the new releases there right now. You can also go to alanalda.com, and when you're there, check out the communication training. There's a lot of stories about the communication training that Mr. Alda does, and it is fascinating. I'm Anthony Iannarino. You can find me at thesalesblog.com, where I post every day. You can also find me at youtube.com/Iannarino, and go pick up my new book, available August 8th, The Lost Art of Closing, Winning the 10 Commitments That Drive Sales. And you can find that book right now at thelostartofclosing.com. And when you're there, you'll pick up lots of bonuses. Until next time, I'm Anthony Iannarino, and I will see you in the arena.
Audio editing and show notes by podcastfasttrack.com. Get 15% off your first month by mentioning this show.